The title of my talk for today is Conceptualizing Women's Empowerment and Health in Ghana. So apparently, you know, it seems like we're switching gears a little bit between what was just discussed. But I think that the topic is still, you know, kind of well-suited to the session, and really just because empowerment, you know, the idea of having access to power and the capacity to make choices and transform those choices into, you know, desired outcomes. I think that's the World Bank's definition of empowerment. This is just a salient thematic notion for women's health across the lifespan, relevant to even, you know, the subpopulations that you guys have talked about. I don't really have anything to disclose. All right. So this is just the review of my presentation for today. My study was comprised of like a literature review and a small statistical analysis. I had to do a lot of research to just kind of establish where we are with conceptualizing empowerment. So for this presentation, it kind of requires that I discuss the literature that helped me develop the conceptual model that I'm presenting. So bear with me. But through the process, I was able to kind of develop, I think, some key considerations for improving the functionality of women's empowerment theory. And, you know, an original conceptual model that hopefully will put some of the power back in the empowerment that we're talking about. And before I really begin, I kind of wanted to give this little description of the inspiration for my work. As was mentioned, I had the opportunity to play in the national soccer team for Ghana for 7 years. And during my tenure with the national team, you know, we had an amazing time. We had silver medal in the African Women's Cup of Nations. We played in the World Cup. In 2005, before I actually entered the doctoral program at UCLA, I presented at a conference on soccer and nationalism. And when I debriefed on my experience, I just realized that I was reporting on several discoveries that I had made informally as a participant observer that really related to empowerment. So, you know, observing this group of women, I found that resources are not the same thing as resourcefulness. It was one of my themes. Self-perception, self-efficacy, and hopelessness can develop and evolve in women. And external events can take on an internal psychological significance. I think that's really what's empowerment. And that significance can change choices and behavior towards better outcomes for women and their children. So even though, you know, these were, again, findings that I derived informally, this is really what has informed my current research and the next wave of qualitative data that I'll be collecting in Ghana. All right. So through my studies, I've recognized that education and health seem to have emerged as co-sponsors of women's empowerment theory and social science literature. You guys may kind of understand what I'm talking about. So these three achievements, education, health, and empowerment, seem to form the trinity of international human development theory and practice. And I think that international public health researchers should have a solid comprehension of the impact of gender inequality on health outcomes and the purpose of education specifically in leveling those inequalities. So my minor is actually in comparative education. I had this quote from Weissman, which just said that a framework based on the oppression of women still dominates much of the literature on women's health worldwide, although a coherent theory of how gender inequalities affect health continues to elude us. More recently, scholars in several disciplines have begun to examine how women's agency, including their health-related decision-making, political participation and organized social movement activities affect their social circumstances and health. So I wanted to kind of include that. You know, this is a sentiment that I arrived at, too, when I finished my review of the literature. It seems like empowerment's being used as an intervening variable and an outcome variable in comparative education and public health research. But women's empowerment theory just remains nebulous, which is just crippling its potential. When I was reflecting on why is this, what I realized is, you know, theory development is usually a circuitous process between inductive and deductive approaches, but grounded theory usually begins with low-level concepts that are scaled up to form, theoretical models. But by contrast, women's empowerment kind of emerged as a paradigmatic concept. So paradigmatic concepts are scientific concepts of very high level of abstraction The thing about it is it's kind of easier to apply, but the risk of misattribution is a lot greater with something like that. So because of that, you know, it's been really, really difficult to operationalize women's empowerment effectively. And then these issues are exacerbated by the real fact that women's empowerment are based on notions of gender and notions of power, which are really contextual, arguably philosophical issues. But because of the importance of power to strategies of change, we can't just eliminate the construct, right? So I was looking at trying to improve the utility of women's empowerment theory in international efforts in education and health-related development work, and by considering the paradox of theoretical examinations versus practical dealings in social science literature, and all of this towards a more complete understanding of how empowerment mediates or moderates the relationship between education and health. All right, so the research questions I started out with was, how has the concept of women's empowerment been operationalized in recent literature? What are the theoretical frameworks that have been employed around the construct? And what are some of the limitations of these conceptual models that are being employed? And then, with a more precise understanding of those, where can we go? So what I did was, immediately after I began this process, I found that there's an abundance of literature on women's empowerment. And recently, the body of literature around women's empowerment in developing nations has also grown in an exponential way. So in 2006, the Institute of Development Studies launched a five-year research program consortium entitled Pathways of Women's Empowerment. And from that, one of the products of that was a bibliography of 38 key texts in women's empowerment. So this is where I started. I consulted these 38 texts, and then I chose 19 for closer reading based on this criteria, basically ones that were relevant to the context that I'm interested in. So I was able to develop kind of a pretty complete arc of how women's empowerment's been constructed from its conception and development literature to the social movement it kind of became in the beginning of the millennium till now, where it's kind of going through like a reconstruction process. And so all of this was really informative and just kind of highlighting some of the merits and challenges in operationalizing empowerment. So when it came down to the concept of empowerment, you know, I just wanted to, you know, give a little bit more context to point out, because not everybody necessarily is familiar with the literature on this. Sen and Groen are pretty much kind of the grandfathers of this idea of empowerment, initiating it as distinct from feminism. And so, you know, in the way that they were distinguishing it from feminism, they were basically saying that empowerment needs to include a diversity of feminisms. It needs to include concerns of women from different regions of the world, and it needs to be defined by the women themselves. And the common thread through all of this, with so much diversity, is just the opposition to gender oppression and other forms of domination. But this has been difficult. There's been, this sparked a really critical discourse because prior to this moment, empowerment had no particular social meaning. Social definitions of terms like empowerment are products of the discourses in which they're embedded, right? So empowerment, that's exactly what happened in this case. In academic literature, empowerment was embedded in this discourse, and there were three problematic presuppositions inherent in the term empowerment that have made the social construction and then the practical deductive application of empowerment an enormous challenge. First, you know, there has to be an agent of empowerment. There's this notion of empowerment as property and a vision of some kind of desirable end state. And so these became increasingly problematic through the literature because of opposing views on the origins of power and differing perspectives on what that desired end state should be. So, you know, as the construction of women's empowerment developed through the 90s, a key question was, how is power derived? If power is derived from within, then empowerment agenda should be agency-oriented. On the other hand, if power is derived from institutional access, then initiatives need to be addressing structural dimensions of empowerment. The merits of viewing power as internal are in the potential for effective interventions to real women with measurable outcomes, but this agency-oriented approach has been critiqued for potentially being a victim-blaming approach because you're focusing so much on the individual. So I just wanted to show this table, just as an example, on commonly used dimensions of empowerment and kind of show kind of where things came with this individual level, household level, community level, and broader arenas of looking at, you know, for example, the legal dimension of empowerment and how it's being scaled broadly. All right, so, you know, we started getting at these mechanical ways of evaluating empowerment, but what has been a big problem is that it seems theoretically development researchers can acknowledge structural causes of disempowerment, but we have not been able to integrate that into our program design and evaluation. So I just concluded that empowerment's been primarily employed as a mediating or moderating variable that's specifying the relationships between education and health, even though we don't have a clear conceptual model. And I wanted to point out a few limitations of the consortium. It's not that there aren't any, and several of them are useful, but specifically with regard to conceptualizing empowerment, the existing model, modeling empowerment is going to require a theoretical causal sequence, which is not present in several of the models. Kabir, who, you know, is an esteemed authority on empowerment, has presented a conceptual model that includes three dimensions: resources, agency, and achievement, and the model is influenced by social and economic preconditions to exercising power. It's useful for differentiating the components of empowerment, but fails to specify causal relationships between resources, agency, and achievements because she views them as interrelated dimensions of the ability to exercise choice. So the only conceptual model that's been integrated into a demographic health survey design actually lacks a causal sequence and therefore can't be related to health outcomes. Among the models representing a causal sequence, the majority of them use preconditions that influence decision-making that leads to empowerment achievements. So these preconditions include dimensions of economic resources and notions held by others, but I'm arguing that these variables are actually structural factors that would mediate or moderate the relationship between an agency-oriented source of empowerment and an achievement. And then also in these models, the way that women can derive power is fairly limited. Usually we see education and economic, you know, microfinance, those kinds of inputs. And I just feel that it's my position that these theorists are conflating resources and resourcefulness. As I said before, and the two are actually not the same. So I wanted to basically know if I could propose and support an original conceptual model for empowerment based on the information that I pulled from the literature and kind of get at this question: what conditions do we require in order to have successful education interventions to empower women? And are these conditions a reflection of personal or structural attributes? And, you know, biases aside, I focus on Ghana, but I feel that Ghana is a really interesting laboratory because it's a nation that's going through a lot of demographic transition right now. So it's rapidly urbanizing. We're seeing a lot of really fascinating trends. And then specifically the women of Ghana compared to women from other parts of the world have played a comparatively active role in economic life. Ghanaian women also kind of rank high on scales measuring individualism and status relative to men, and they've been perceived as confident and ambitious. So there's all these studies that are kind of drawing out these things of women in Ghana in particular. Yet, compared to men in Ghana, we still see, you know, these gender inequalities where women are experiencing greater poverty, having heavier time burdens. So these findings all kind of undermine the notion of trickle-down empowerment, which I think is also kind of a thematic way that we've been addressing our development initiatives. So I did build a conceptual model using the Ghana DHS, the Demographic Health Survey is a national survey covering all 10 regions of the country. It's done in several countries worldwide, you guys are probably familiar. But I used the 2008 survey, which included a module on domestic violence, and I actually considered a subset survey, which was a couple survey, so it was where they collected data from women and their partners. So the sample size was 1883. I used some chi-squared analysis to test my model, and as far as variable selection, I just tried to use variables that were commonly appearing in the literature as proxies for empowerment. So as far as what came up, so here's the first example of my conceptual model with results from chi-squared analysis. The focal relationship is between education and fertility. Choosing education because we all know that this is, you know, a commonly supported intervention approach, and it has really important relationships to health outcomes. And then fertility, especially for this region in West Africa where maternal mortality rates are like 1 in 8, you know, the bearing on health is super significant. So my goal is to use what we would describe as interpersonal variables as input in the focal relationship, and empowerment achievements are derived from the literature. The intervening variable in this model is a setting for empowerment. So you can see source of empowerment to an empowerment achievement, and we have this setting variable that's supposed to represent something structural that's going to mediate or moderate the relationship between those two things. So here what's shown is that the relationship between education and fertility is moderated by age at first marriage. So another way of looking at this is to represent the data this way, and you can see how the slope of the line shifts when we break these groups out by this other intervening variable characteristic. So effectively, where education is an agency-oriented strategy to lower fertility, we see the effectiveness is impacted by structural dynamics such as the age of first marriage. All right, and then this is just another example, focal relationships between education and control over household resources. I really found this one to be fascinating because basically the relationship between education and control over household resources does not exist without the intervening variable has skilled occupation outside the home. So, you know, here we are putting efforts into education, assuming that we're going to have this relationship. You know, if a person is educated, then they would have a say in the way resources are divided and used in their household. But it's actually not the case unless a woman can find a job outside the home that she's using that education, where she's, you know, using the education that she's gained to be able to make more decisions and have more influence in her household. So these kinds of findings can really inform our approaches to education and empowerment and health interventions for women in this context. So as far as preliminary conclusions, I think broad takeaways from this, all people experience power and powerlessness at different times. All people. Women derive power in different ways and translate that power into measurable improvements in their lives, health and overall well-being. The translation of agency-oriented power derivation is either facilitated or hindered by structural institutional factors that create the context for empowerment processes. And so this is kind of, you know, where I feel, this is a point of view that I feel is a little bit innovative, as opposed to this whole notion of preconditions that then would allow you to be empowered. So understanding the process of empowerment this way helps us to design better intervention approaches by working with women to determine the desired outcomes. So that last box, you know, this is something where qualitatively we can ask them, what is empowerment to you? Because I've used, you know, fertility, but my grandmother is West African and she took great pride in the fact that she bore 8 children. So, you know, who knows what is really an empowerment outcome? And then refining our approaches and concentrating our resources on investments that are truly sources of empowerment for women. And then really integrating the structural dimension of empowerment into the theory of our program design, which we haven't been able to do as effectively previously. So from these results, one can conclude that, you know, efforts in education, for example, should be coupled with strategies to delay marriage in order to yield the maximum benefit. You can also conclude that without opportunities for employment, there's no real significant outcome to benefit to receiving a high school education, and these are more, it's more of a structural issue that needs to be addressed at a higher ecological level. So I think what's cool too here is that it kind of, this model allows us to know when to focus on personal attributes and when to look at structural dimensions. And so these experiments were informative, but obviously subject to limitations. The study that I was looking at wasn't really designed for this. I just used the data set that was available. And the next step for me is going to be looking at the Women's Health Survey of Accra and basically running the same kind of analyses, which is just another data set for the same region, to see if I can vet out similar relationships. But ultimately, it's going to be important to conduct more qualitative research with women in Ghana. And right now, I have an NIH grant in review, so hopefully, that's what I'll be doing next. A few citations and thanks.